This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of arts and culture love from NPR. I'm Netta Ulaby, arts reporter.
And I'm Justine Cannon, producer for All Things Considered.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
Linda Holmes tells us why this was TV's decade.
Author P.D. James delves into what makes a good detective story.
And Bob Mundella considers the worst films of the last 10 years. But first,
we consider the end of the decade in music. Over the last month, NPR Music has looked back at the past 10 years, trying to pinpoint signal events from each year that, for better or for worse, changed our culture. One of the biggest sources of delight and concern for musicians and fans, the internet. It's changed how people get their music, and websites have emerged as important arbiters of musical taste. Joel Rose reports that one year in particular, 2004, was a watershed for the music blog.
Hardly anyone in the U.S. had heard of Arcade Fire in the fall of 2004 when the band released its full-length debut, Funeral. By then, the Montreal band was already familiar to readers of a music blog called Said the Gramophone. Shawn Michaels had been writing about music online and posting MP3s of his favorite songs for about a year.
We joke about what happens when the album comes out, then when it did come out, and things began to accelerate sort of even beyond anything we had imagined. What, David Bowie was at their concert? You know, Bruce Springsteen's singing with them? What's going on? It was just sort of inconceivable, this youthful imaginings manifest.
Funeral went on to sell nearly 500,000 copies. Arcade Fire was one of the first bands to show that buzz on a handful of music blogs and websites could lead to actual mainstream success. Record labels took note.
We get far more attention from all corners of the music world now.
Scott Plagenhoff is the editor-in-chief at PitchforkMedia.com. The site was one of the first to run a rave review of the Arcade Fire album. But back then, Plagenhoff says Pitchfork was having a hard time getting major labels to take the site seriously.
They were very suspicious. You know, trying to get someone on the phone to get a hip-hop record or a major label rock record at the time was extremely difficult, where now it's major labels are a lot more cooperative.
The music industry has even come to accept MP3 blogs, where fans post their favorite songs for other people to hear and, yes, download for free. That's a practice the industry spent years and millions of dollars trying to fight. But Sonal Gandhi at Forrester Research says many labels are now willing to tolerate MP3 bloggers as long as they're helping to promote new product.
If it's an artist that few people know about, and blogs might actually build a hype around it. It's sort of cost of doing business.
For many labels, it's become standard operating procedure to put out one MP3 from each album that bloggers can share freely, says Shawn Michaels at Said the Gramophone.
You never hear nowadays of labels trying to shut down blogs unless they're just posting full album zipped files or something like that. You know, the labels are pals.
Of course, buzz on the blogs doesn't always translate into success. Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah is one example of a band that has so far failed to deliver on its early hype. Shawn Michaels says now there's something of a backlash against so-called blog bands.
People will even use the term blog bands to sort of smear bands that pick up early hype and then don't live up to their reputation. But I think that for the formula of internet promotion equals longevity to work, the bands really need to be great artists.
The conversation may have moved online, but Shawn Michaels says it's still the music itself that gets people excited, or doesn't. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
And speaking of massive changes on the media landscape, Justine.
Indeed. Do you remember when people watched TV on a TV set?
Indeed.
Well, shows had scripts and they hired professional actors. Now it's so-called reality shows and HDV, DVR, TNT. 10 years ago this month, there was almost no reality television, and networks still had a near stranglehold on quality scripted content. We generally watch TV using that quaint device, the television said. And for most people, watching a show anytime other than its regular time slot meant hauling out a VHS tape. Linda Holmes, who writes about pop culture at the NPR blog Monkey See and also hosts this podcast, recently told NPR's Scott Simon that as we edge our way toward the second decade of the century, a lot has changed when it comes to TV.
Well, obviously, there's been a great, in the last 10 years, a great movement toward watching television in other ways other than sitting in front of your TV. And that has led people to be much more able to pick and choose a lot more carefully. They're not as much at the mercy of scheduling and what's on opposite what. And it used to be that there were these massive collisions when they put The Simpsons on opposite The Cosby Show. It was this big issue for the networks to set things against each other. Now it doesn't matter as much. And in fact, that's one of the things that's been so tough for the new Jay Leno show at 10 o'clock. It's not that they're losing to the other things on at 10 o'clock. They're losing to people watching things on their DVR that they've taped.
10 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. And if we'd been sitting here 10 years ago, there are technological developments that we couldn't have predicted. But anything you want to throw out as a supposition?
My guess would be that 10 years from now, rather than paying for cable, you're going to be paying something for content that you're going to be able to watch on your TV or on your computer or on your phone or whatever you want. 10 years ago, there wasn't even iTunes. Yeah. So the whole concept of buying content online and downloading it and paying for it piece by piece, it's very difficult to look at and say what is going to change the way people watch. But there's no question that the commercial supported broadcast model is in a lot of trouble.
I think it's a buyer's market out with TV. I think that's really the fun thing about TV. And I feel like, totally making this up here, I feel like the quality of TV has just risen tremendously in 10 years. And I don't know if it's because there is that competition and there, you know, we get to pick and choose. We are not subject to their clock. So that, I think, has been really exciting.
Well, where the development of media may take us in the next 10 years is probably going to remain a mystery for a while. But the author P.D. James has a definition of detective fiction that is as neatly constructed as one of her famous mystery novels. James has been writing detective fiction for nearly half a century. Her latest book is about her craft. It's called Talking About Detective Fiction, and it's a very personal and affectionate look at the art, the evolution, and the conventions of the mystery novel. NPR's Linda Wertheimer spoke with James and asked her if she thought her definition of a detective story has changed much over the years.
I mean, in the Golden Age, what was important was you had an original method of death. People were killed in most extraordinary ways. But nowadays, I think we look for greater realism. It's interesting if you can have an original method of death, but the book should be realistic and the people should be realistic. So I think we are trying to be truer to life and also to say something about the society in which we live.
I'd like to go back to that phrase you used, the Golden Age. The Golden Age of detective fiction is generally regarded as the couple of decades between the First and Second World Wars. This was a time when lots of people started writing, I gather, in their spare time and produced a lot of very clever, very witty crime fiction of a certain kind.
One gets the impression they were writing for their own entertainment as much as for the entertainment of the readers. And I think they were enjoying it greatly. And the books are ingenious and often very funny. And they've lasted, which is interesting.
That is interesting. The four women authors who stand out for you, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, and I have no idea how to pronounce.
Well, I think it's Nio.
That's why I thought it was Nio. Nio
yes,
Marsh.
You're absolutely right, Nio.
From New Zealand. I mean, their books are all in print.
And they are
still read. What do you think was their influence?
Well, I think that they showed that it was important to write well. Dorothy L. Sayers wrote extremely well, for example, so that they lifted a rather despised genre into a form which could be taken seriously. Then they were very ingenious. They're very clever in their plotting. And we do care very much about their heroes. Of course, their heroes are as different from a real-life detective as they could possibly be.
Did their choice of how to create a character affect your choice when you set out to create your character, your detective?
I'm not sure it did, except for Dorothy L. Sayers. I think I was quite strongly influenced by her, by the structure and the plotting and by the quality of the writing. I wasn't influenced at all by Agatha Christie. I read her with great pleasure, but it seemed to me that she was basically a puzzler. At the end of the book, you put it away thinking, well, how clever that was, but knowing that it could couldn't possibly happen in real life. We're in Christie land, which is a very good place to be, but it's not reality. It's a different kind of reality.
So you, I think you were shooting.
She was trying to write about the society in which she lived and about reasonable detection, I think.
And you should know, Netta, if you have a mystery book, you should give it, save it for Linda Wertheimer. She is a true consumer of the mystery. Loves them, loves them, loves them. If you need to know something about mysteries, she is really the hound around here.
Unless you want to know how to pronounce Naomi Marsh.
Right. That's why we have the library.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Many surgeons listen to music in the operating room. Surveys tell us as much, and so do surgeons. That's just one intersection of music and healing, and it's one that's received little, if any, rigorous study until now. Dr. Claudius Conrad is a German-born surgeon in Boston who was also trained as a concert pianist and has a PhD in music philosophy. Robert Siegel spoke with Conrad about what effect music in the operating room has on the work of the surgeon.
One study that you did compares the effects of different kinds of music. We're going to be hearing about different kinds of music, so let's hear samples of both kinds. First, this is a recording of it's a recording of you playing the piano, actually. What are we hearing?
This is a slow movement from Mozart's piano sonatas in D major, Köchelverzeichnis 576.
Mm-hmm. And now we're going to hear an example of something, it's a word that I was unfamiliar with, of music that you call dichaeotic. What are we listening to there?
We are listening to experimental music, and one of our interests was to study the effects of auditory stress on surgical performance, and especially on individual components of performance. Is it speed or is it accuracy influenced by auditory stress? And the results were surprising.
So in that particular piece of dichaotic music, in one, we're hearing two different things in two different channels. Those of you listening in stereo can probably hear this, but in one channel we're hearing this. Heavy metal music?
That's right, death metal music, to be more precise.
And in the other channel we're hearing this. Sounds like German folk music.
It is indeed, and research has shown that indeed vocal music seems to be more distracting under certain circumstances than instrumental music. And for us, it was an experimental tool to test in a standardized fashion auditory stress.
Yeah, the auditory stress. You say this is done with a simulator. You are not actually having patients operated on while playing that music, which I think violates the U.S. Army field manual for interrogations, the music you're playing.
That wouldn't pass an IRB and shouldn't be done. No, we had a very well-designed simulator that tested for minimal invasive surgery, laparoscopic surgery, and of course, with those virtual reality simulators, time until completion of a task can be very accurately measured.
And the finding that people who had to listen to this dichaotic music still completed the task successfully, but it took them more time.
Yes, and those were very senior expert of surgeons. So now we also looked at people who were early in their career, they're novices of surgery. How does stress influence their performance, which is a very realistic situation? A young surgeon operates in the operating room and the floor calls in, or there's a conversation in the background, there's noise induced by machines we use in the operating room. And interestingly, with them, the influence by this dichaeotic music varied a great deal. And this is data that will come out soon.
Well, I was stressed listening to that German folk music.
I can't imagine having both in either ear. It was very, I don't know if it's more stressful for the patient or the surgeon.
It was dichaeotic for sure.
Well, something that I did hear this week that gave me great pleasure was the discussion that Renee Montagne had with Colin Firth about his new movie, A Single Man. It's directed by Tom Ford. It's a new term for the fashion designer known for his sleek, sexy look that he created for Gucci. It stars, as I said, Colin Firth as English professor George Falconer. And George is unable to emerge from his grief over the loss a few months earlier of the man he loved for 16 years. part of the conversation that Firth had with René was about how his character, George, is spending his day doing what he would normally do, but also preparing to kill himself.
In his own mind, he's made a very rational decision. This isn't a hysterical decision. It's a simple analysis of the situation. There is nothing in his philosophy which makes life worth continuing with. There was only one person that he genuinely loved. He's lost that person. I mean, that's the starting point. What the film is about is the things that happened to him during that day which challenged that perspective.
Well, some of the things that happen include the life with his great love, Jim, who died in a car accident, and he occasionally we see flashbacks.
Yes, the memories of that relationship are not necessarily the relationship at its most passionate or sexual or dramatic. They're the memories of quite ordinary things. In fact, I think the film deals in ordinary things from beginning to end, but it gives them a poetry. So when he looks back at his life with his lover, Jim, it's sitting on the sofa together reading a book, arguing about whose turn it is to change the record.
Really quite mundane moments, really, that you think, why are they coming back to him?
Well, because those are the kind of levels of comfort that are impossible to replace when you miss them. That comfort level takes, one could say, 16 years to acquire, and that's what he's not going to find again, certainly not tomorrow. If it was their first night of passion, you know, one could imagine, you know, a night of passion could be found again, you know, within the foreseeable future. But not that deep, profound level of familiarity. That's what he's missing, I think. And also those things that seemed ordinary at the time, now that he can't have them anymore, and we all know what this is like, you know, you don't know what you've got till you've lost it. Things that seemed ordinary at the time now seem incredibly precious. But what's interesting, I think, in this story is that that's actually happening to his present. Because he's about to leave the planet, the everyday things that he sees take on that intensity that usually only belongs to the past. You know, when he sees a child, it's the neighbor's kid. This is the family who've been getting on his nerves for as long as he can remember. But on this particular occasion, the sight of this child is something exquisite. She's the most beautiful child he's ever seen. When he sees a sunset, to him it's something beatific. Well, we know it's just the smog that makes it as red as that. The rent boy trying to pick him up outside the liquor store.
The hustler.
Yeah, is now has the most beautiful face of any human. Mind you, that actor probably does anyway.
I was going to say, he does have one of the most beautiful faces.
He does.
As I said, I'm very excited about this film, and I really would love to see what Tom Ford does with the 60s, with L.A. 60s, and that must just be gorgeous to look at as well.
Well, reviews for this one have been strong, but I'm sure over the past year you might have slapped down $10 for a ticket to a film so foul you choked on the popcorn. It's time for Payback, NPR style. Film critic Bob Mondello has caught the worst offenders of the past 10 years. And as he told NPR's Guy Raz, when he was considering the worst of the decade, he focused not on direct-to-DVD failures, but on those movies that people actually went to and got burned by their sheer awfulness. Bob started with the decade's worst romance.
I considered Gigli, the Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez specialty, but the public somehow knew about that, and they didn't go to it. On the other hand, they did go to the Matthew McConaughey picture, Fool's Gold. It was enough to put me off the whole genre. Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson.
Who else?
Exactly. They were a recently divorced couple searching for hidden treasure. They're spitting venom at each other through most of this film.
If we don't go after that treasure, it's going to haunt us the rest of our lives, and you know it. You really think I'd lie about this?
Why not? You're a liar.
I mean, this is such an inappropriate time to dwell on that.
Bob, this is so painful.
It was. They were amazingly bad. And, you know, it was clear that they had complete contempt for the material. And Matthew McConaughey, if I never see him again, it'll be too soon.
Ouch, ouch.
Well, you know, he'll eventually make a good movie. The thing is that at one point, he showed some promise. He was making serious pictures.
Yeah, he was in Richard Linklater films.
Right. And then it all just sort of went away. And he's decided to make these silly comedies. And now it's a little embarrassing. He's at least pushing 40, and he's still acting like a teenager. And it's awful.
All right, the next movie is a familiar punching bag for a lot of critics. I don't know if it's entirely fair, but I guess we have to talk about the worst science fiction film of the decade, and it is...
Battlefield Earth. It's kind of a walk, too. John Travolta's salute to the sci-fi writing of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. It was released in 2000, and Elvis Mitchell, writing in the New York Times at the time, said, and I quote, "It may be a bit early to make such judgments, but Battlefield Earth may turn out to be the worst movie of the century." How about that? The year is 3000 in this picture. Aliens, who are called Cyclos, have defeated Earth in a war that lasted 9 minutes and basically exterminated the planet and are now using humans as slave labor to strip the planet. And John Travolta is Turl, their leader.
As long as you were providing me with useful information, I wouldn't file the report. But now that I'm leaving this pitiful excuse for a planet, you will no longer be providing me with useful information, will you?
I'm begging you. My son just got accepted into the academy. First one ever in my family. You know how much it costs. Please, as a friend, wouldn't you forget to file the report?
Well, as a friend, I could forget to file the report. But unfortunately, I'm not your friend!
And
now that laugh was constant in this picture, and you just wanted to die while you were watching it. It was
I wonder if this film could have another life as sort of a cult classic film.
Sure,
you know, watched by sort of college kids.
Yeah, the problem is it was long and just sort of exhausting, and it's really dark and it isn't fun. You wanted it to be fun, and it's just terrible.
And now the moment we've all been waiting for: Bob Mondello's worst film of the decade. Bob, the worst film of the decade is?
Well, certainly the most annoying one is Mike Myers' The Love Guru.
Oh.
Is he Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now?
Rajneesh, let's make like a baby and head out.
The Love Guru is the story of a very needy guru who is played by what seems to be a very needy Mike Myers, who is hired to motivate the Toronto Maple Leafs.
The hockey team.
His methods include lewd self-help mantras, elephant erotica, and an endless supply of jokes about male endowment.
Damn.
Looks like he's smuggling a schnauzer.
It was so bad. It was coarse and unpleasant. Mike Myers is so full of himself in the picture. I mean, he's almost winking at the camera. He is smirking at his own jokes. He makes you want to throttle him. Listen.
You're breaking out in hives in the studio. But you did sit through every last minute of all of these movies we've been talking about. You're pretty resilient, Bob.
Yeah, I guess. I've still got the best job in the world. I see an awful lot more movies than most people, though, and a lot of them are not, shall we say, of the first water.
I refuse to see that movie. It looks so bad, so I guess Bob nailed it once again.
He described it. We were talking about this. Bob and I, he was getting ready for the piece, and he was, you know, going through all of these different possibilities, considering some, holding them up to the light, discarding them. And I remember at one point he described Matthew McConaughey as a treasure trove of annoying.
I will say, though, his role in Dazed and Confused is brilliant as the creepy older guy who hangs out with the high school kids. I really, he could have just ended his career then. That would have been great.
Peaked in the 90s. Let's see. Well, that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Justine Kennan.
And I'm Netta Ulavi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.